This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
تمسك بحبل الله واتبع الهدى ولا تك بدعيا لعلك تفلح ودن بكتاب الله والسنن التي أتت عن رسول الله تنجو وتربح وقل غير مخلوق كلام مليكنا بذلك دان الأتقياء.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome, respected listeners, respected viewers who are joining us once again on another amazing, fantastic interview here at the Islamic Literature Society. We bring you some amazing interviews with authors on amazing and interesting topics. Now, the Islamic Literature Society was founded in 2019 with the aim of promoting, fostering, and developing a heightened appreciation for authors and literary works of classical and contemporary scholarship. Now, we achieve this through a number of different ways. We have book clubs, we have book reviews, which you can see across our website. And the most interesting and the most direct way of developing this relationship with our books and our respected author is through these interviews, alhamdulillah. So today we have a very special guest, and the topic is one that you do not want to miss out. What we have with us today, inshallah, is the book titled Slavery and Islam, and it is written by Jonathan A.C. Brown, who is with us today. A quick insight or background into Dr. Jonathan. Jonathan A.C. Brown is a professor of Islamic studies at the Al-Walid Ibn Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And mashallah, doctor has written a number of different books. I have a few of them with me here. We've got Misquoting Muhammad, which we'll get the author's opinions on as well. And we also got Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and the Modern World. So alhamdulillah, there's a number of things there. So let us begin by bringing in the Sheikh. Okay, Doctor, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you?
Wa alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm good, and I'm really happy to see you and meet you in online.
Alhamdulillah.
Sheikh, and I'm honored to have been invited to be in this podcast.
Mashallah, you look very relaxed today, I must say so.
That's how I always, I'm usually pretty relaxed, except when I get upset about stuff.
Okay, good. Which means you're not upset today.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, good. All right, Sheikh, let's start off, inshallah. If we can start by a simple question about your journey through Islamic learning. All right, mashallah, you've authored a number of different books. So could you tell us how you've got to where you are today, please?
Sorry, I'm just looking at something going on outside, which is okay, it's fine. Sorry, my kid is just wandering around, but he's... So Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, thanks for inviting me. I apologize, you caught me at a kind of weird time on my site. My beard trimmer broke, so I can't stand having a long beard. It just really itches me. So if it gets longer than maybe a week and a half or 2 weeks, I just shave my beard and then grow it back. That's why I don't have any kind of beard right now. You have a much bigger beard than me.
Okay, you look pretty good in the back of your book, the picture in the back of your book.
Yeah. I mean, I like the, in the Persian, it's called tahrish, short beard, Iranian guy beard. Designer stubble, as my friend Asad calls it.
Okay.
So sorry, this is kind of repeating stuff I've said in other places, but you asked me the question, so I'll do my best to answer it. So I became Muslim when I was in college and university. I was about 19 years old, I think. And I became Muslim really through kind of like reading books of Muhammad Asad, The Road to Mecca, his tafsir of the Quran. So I came really through a maybe like kind of modernist window in the sense of reading like Fazlur Rahman and things like that. And it was actually not until I was in graduate school that I the idea that you could go and meet like Muslim scholars today and, you know, traditional ulama and study with them. Like they were previously, they just sort of been somebody like, you know, like museum pieces, right? That they were kind of obsolete things of the past. when I went to Egypt in 2000 to 2001 for a year to learn Arabic, I started to attend the Durus in the Azhar, the open Durus. And then I really started to do that more in 2003, in the summer of 2003. And 2003, I think. No. Yeah, I think so. I can't remember now. It's something like that.
Okay.
2002 or 2003. And then I, after that, I would go back like every summer for at least a month. And then 2006, I went for about 8 months and did like private studies with like very intensive private studies with scholars in like hadith and fiqh and usul, fiqh and grammar and urud and things like that.
Sure.
But the, you know, that, but that was really, I mean, I never did what you did, for example. I never did and went and did like intensive, you know, full like curriculum studies. So for me, you know, my Islamic learning, traditional Islamic learning is, there's a few things that I have, you know, like ijazas to teach. You know, it was really, it's not something that I would ever like boast about as being something substantial. I mean, it, I would say it gave me enough skill to be able to kind of navigate things generally, and then also to know when I needed help to understand things. I think that's the more important thing. So in a lot of ways, I think my, you know, my work as a scholar in the US has been to try and kind of integrate classical, you know, kind of Islamic learning and Western learning.
Okay.
And kind of bring, especially kind of translate the former and bring it into view in English language world and in kind of Western readership. That's what I see myself, I mean, mostly as a translator in that sense.
Okay, mashallah, mashallah. Okay, so Jonathan, if we can move over into the book, Slavery and Islam. As you can imagine, the topic is a very touchy topic. Can I ask, why did you pick such a topic?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, most Muslims, I'm not sure. I can certainly tell you that, you know, I remember when I was in college, I remember very clearly, I mentioned this in the book, you know, which is that I remember being at home reading, you know, Muhammad Asad's translation of the Quran and coming across, I think it's in Surah An-Nahl, that, what is it? يَدْرُبُ اللَّهُ مَثَلْ رَجُلٌ رَزَقْنَهُ رِزْقًا حَسَنًا, I think, or Abdul Mamluk and La Yaqdiru ala Shay, right? So, and then I can't really, I'm probably mixing the order up there, but the you know, that the Quran talks about slave owned who doesn't have any, can't do anything. And it's using a slave and a free person as a parable for like a false god that doesn't have any power, and then like actual God who has power, as far as I understand it, right? So, but what I was shocked by, I was like, wait a second, like you can't just mention slavery. You know, you have to say slavery is wrong, and you have to like, how can you just talk about it and not even say that, right? And so I remember being kind of concerned and confused, but I sort of just moved on, and I guess sort of swept it under the carpet. But I think that's probably the position that a lot of Muslims are in. Well, globally, probably, I mean, maybe less so in some parts of the world than others, but I think maybe globally, is that they, you know, they come across these references to slavery in the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet or Islamic law or something.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, it's sort of, you don't really know what sense to make of it, because not only does their religion seem to be allowing and endorsing this thing that, you know, anybody in the world today would know is a grotesque, horrific evil, but also sometimes it's not even presented as any kind of moral problem. It's just sort of mentioned offhand. So, I think a lot of people, maybe this was an issue of concern, but it's not something that we come across in our daily lives. So it wasn't, maybe a huge concern. But I did eventually mean to write about it. But then when the ISIS thing happened, I think it was like 2014 or 15.
Right.
And there was the kind of enslavement of ISIS girls, I mean, of Yazidi girls and things. So that, and this was in the newspapers everywhere, and people, you know, I think this caused a big crisis of faith for a lot of Muslims, because not only did they see this being done, but they're also, ISIS was like, wait, what are you guys so confused about? Like, the Quran talks about this is allowed in the Sharia. This is what the Prophet did. So what are you guys, what are you objecting to? And Muslims didn't really have an answer, a really convincing answer for how to respond to this. So that really made me want to write about this. And eventually I wrote a book about it.
Yeah, mashallah, you addressed the issue of ISIS to the latter part of your book. In the opening chapter, in the introduction, you actually address the moral question. Can we actually talk about slavery? In particular, you address yourself. Can you talk about slavery? What was that question referring to?
You mean, what can we talk about slavery? Like, is there such a thing as slavery defined transhistorically, or what is the big question that's behind this issue?
In the sense that, you know, there's a consensus about slavery being wrong and it's an evil in nature. Yeah. Can we actually talk about it in that perspective?
Yeah, I think that, I think this is certainly the case in the US. I think it might be a little bit less in the UK, but probably fairly similar. But I think the US is really the place where this is the clearest, I mean, the strongest manifestation of this phenomenon. But I call it the kind of the slavery conundrum, which is that the kind of the abolitionist consensus, which is the sort of global abolitionist consensus, which is that slavery is an kind of gross, intrinsic evil throughout space and time. So, you know, slavery was wrong. It's wrong today. It was wrong 100 years ago. It was wrong 1,000 years ago. It was wrong 2,000 years ago. And that's axiomatic, right? You cannot question that. If you do, I mean, you're a monster, right? I mean, imagine just going in and being like, well, slavery is not that bad, or it was okay back then. I mean, you would, you know, really be pilloried. The second sort of, I talk about the slavery conundrum is basically being that there's three maxims or three axioms,
okay,
that you can't really, you can't question, but also you can't hold them all at the same time, right? So you can't actually question any of these, or you can only do it at a great cost, but also you cannot actually hold all these three things at the same time. So the first one is slavery is a gross intrinsic evil across space and time. The second one is that all slavery is slavery. So there's no like good slavery, bad slavery, okay slavery, it's light slavery, heavy slavery, right? So, you know, just imagine going into a meeting or something, or, you know, saying, oh, the slavery in ISIS is not that bad or something. You know, just imagine saying like it's not that bad and what the reaction would be.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So you can't make internal distinctions within slavery. Slavery is an absolute intrinsic evil throughout space and time. All slavery, anytime the word is used, absolute intrinsic evil throughout space and time. The third axiom is that our pasts have some kind of moral or legal claim on us, right? So, I mean, for Muslims, it's obvious in the sense that we look to the Quran, the Sunnah for moral guidance, for spiritual guidance, right? If you're, you know, Americans would say we look to the Constitution of the United States for guidance. You know, Christians would look to Jesus and the New Testament, Jews and the Old Testament, you know, Buddhists to Buddhist literature, Hindus to Hindu literature, right? So people who are philosophers to philosophical literature. All of these traditions, right? So there's every single religious, or every single major religious and every single philosophical tradition that I know of, either defended, condoned slavery, or thought it was just completely normal until the earliest, the absolute earliest, the late 1600s.
You know? Okay.
So if you're going to say that, you know, slavery is a gross intrinsic evil throughout space and time, there's all slavery is slavery, if somebody is defending or involved in or condoning that, they're like they're morally compromised person, right? So they can't, you know, imagine somebody coming into public life today and saying, well, I think slavery is okay or something. I mean, they would never, you know, this person would never be allowed to be in public life. So the same thing for our past, right? If these people are defending it, then why are we, do you take moral guidance from people who defended slavery, who thought it was fine? Would you ever get moral or spiritual advice from those people?
No, of course not. Yeah.
But the problem is that the entirety of the human heritage prior to, at the earliest, the late 1600s, was guilty of this. The entire, the sort of statue issue is actually a really good case of this, right? Where the people who come out and say, we want to take down the statue of this guy in Bristol, or we want to take down the statue of Thomas Jefferson because they were involved in slavery. Like, those people are logically, they're totally correct. Logically, they are, according to the logic of the slavery conundrum, they're 100% correct.
Sure.
Slavery is a gross and intrinsic evil throughout space and time. It's history's greatest crime, right? No moral person, no person with any moral sense could ever be involved in this or support it.
Yeah.
Or defend it. So if they did, you absolutely should not have a statue of this person. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's like having a statue of Hitler, right? So that's a totally logical conclusion.
Okay.
And then the people who come up and say, well, but you know, it's more complicated. Da, 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 da. No, it's not. I mean, then what are you trying to say? Why is it more complicated? Oh, back then it wasn't clear. Wait, so back then slavery wasn't evil? Like, a smart, intelligent person shouldn't have realized it wasn't evil. It's like, oh, well, yeah. So they have to start fudging and waffling, because the logic of slavery is a gross intrinsic evil throughout space and time, all slavery is slavery. The logical conclusion is, if somebody's involved in that, they are history. I mean, they should never be turned to for moral authority. It should never be celebrated. But the problem is, as you know, conservative British or people would tell you, these are our heroes, right? These are the people we look to for inspiration and, you know, Darkest Hour and, you know, Never Surrender and all that stuff, right? And these are the people we turn to.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, right? The guy who said, all men are created equal and endowed with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? That amazing human being, with a brilliant person, but who had a slave and had children with his slave concubine, and those children were slaves, et cetera, et cetera. George Washington, father of the United States of America. By the way, this idea that he somehow hated slavery deep down is utter hooey. There's a book that came out just recently, about a year ago. It's a great book called Never Caught.
Okay.
It's about this slave woman named Ona Judge, who she fled from the Washingtons when they were in Philadelphia. And they spent the rest of their lives hunting or trying to hunt her down. I mean, they never gave up trying to get her back. So okay. They were not some kind of, you know, closet abolitionists or something.
So,
but I mean, I mean, I live in Washington. I live in Washington, D.C., which is named after him. I mean, imagine the sheer number of things you'd have to pull down. I mean, how would American identity function? So that's the slavery conundrum, is that we hold positions, three positions, that none of which you can really question. I mean, people do question them. They say we should take down the statues, but that's very controversial, right? And until relatively recently, that would have just been laughed out of the room, right?
So, this brings me to another question, because we're talking about slavery, you know, through history, as you just mentioned. You also discuss in the first chapter of your book the definition of slavery, and that chapter goes on quite a bit. I mean, it's almost like you struggle in defining slavery. So can we address that topic? Can we come to an agreement on what we are actually talking about?
Yeah. Let me just say that first, the reason why these positions are these axiomatic positions exist is because of the nature of how abolitionism was kind of debated and eventually triumphed, right? Which is that when abolitionists were pushing for slaveholders to, you know, for the end of slavery, people who were either slaveholders or supportive of slaveholding industries or laws, they'd say things like, you're right, like certain forms of slavery are horrific, but that's not what we're doing, right? They're like, our slavery is okay, or slavery in India is okay, or slavery here is not that bad. So that was the first, one of the first responses, sort of rebuttals that kind of pro-slavery people would use. So they had to shut that door and just say that, no, this is something that, if something is slavery, it is inherently evil. It's not discussed, it's not negotiable. One of the other responses of pro-slavery people would be to actually push back on the definition of slavery in essence, because what they'd say, like in the 1830s, you saw this in some very prominent kind of defenses of slavery in Virginia, in the American South, they'd say that, Well, look, okay, you know, look at your industrial workers in New York or Chicago or London. I mean, these people are treated horribly. They die in these poor houses. It's a crime in England. It's actually a crime to leave work, not show up to work. You can be put in prison for that. So, you know, look, but my slaves, you know, they're cared for, they're fed, they're housed. We take care of them when they're sick. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying this is what people said.
Right.
So they'd say, like, you know, if you want to talk about who's being treated badly, then your workers are much worse off. So that's why the abolitionists had to focus on the legal institution of slavery. They didn't want to make it about conditions or who's being treated well or not. It had to be about this legal status of not being free or being property. But you can see in this example kind of one of the tensions, which is what is in one society we can come up with a very, you know, like in America, United States, slavery is status of not being free, or in Roman law it's a status of not being free, or in and also of being property, or in, you know, medieval and kind of early modern European law, it's being property of somebody, right? So
right.
You can think about slavery as not being free, legal status of not being free, legal status of being property. But the other approach is to think about slavery as like a condition, that it's about the way you're treated. And so until the kind of the 1926, when there's this convention, international convention signed to kind of end slave trade, basically slavery becomes illegal. And then that is gradually ratified and accepted until 1960s, when every country had abolished slavery legally, at least.
Okay.
From after that, you get more of a move towards kind of slavery as a condition, right? Because once there's no longer something called slavery, it's easy. There's no slavery anymore. Okay, fine. It's gone. Mm. Finito. Now, what happens if you're treating the person exactly the same way? They're just not technically a slave. So there was instead of saying, you know, slaves are property, it was slaves are treated like property, or slaves are people who are paid only subsistence wages and don't have control of their labor. And especially, this is a big thing, they're coerced. So a big definition, especially in what's called new abolitionism since the 1990s, okay, against, you know, what people call modern day slavery, is the idea that it's coerced labor, that they're coerced. Now, we can, so in any particular society or even in a civilization, you might be able to come up with a very good definition of slavery, because you have a kind of maybe a clear understanding of freedom, what freedom means, what property means. But the problem is that freedom, things like freedom and property, are so vague that if you try to think about them transhistorically and globally, they stop having any meaning, right? So if you say, what is free? Like, are you free, Junaid? What can you do? You know, can you walk outside naked? No, you can't. So you're not free. You can do everything. You can do anything you want, except what's illegal. Okay, that's free. But then slaves can also do whatever they want. I mean, if a slave is sitting in their room, like after work, and they're twiddling their thumbs, they can twiddle their thumbs this way, or they can twiddle their thumbs this way, right?
Yeah.
They're free to choose. So they're also free, except for what the law and their owner says. So freedom and slavery aren't two diametrically opposed things. They're just two different levels of restriction. Mm-hmm. And where that level is depends on, or where the distinction is depends on your particular society and your particular time. But you try to think of it, and when some scholars who are very skeptical about this, but who try to insist that there's like kind of a minimum rights that all humans agree on that free people have, Suzanne Myers says this in her great essay on definition of slavery. She actually can't. She says surely there's a number of rights that we agree everybody has if they're free, but she doesn't say what the rights are, because they're not actually there. I don't think there are agreed upon rights.
Mm.
And you could say, well, let's say I can't, you know, a slave owner can like kill their slave with no consequences. First of all, most slave systems in history, that's not true. Islamic law, for example, you can't just kill your slave.
No, yeah. So
you can't even really hurt them. I mean, you can't really hurt them seriously. Right. And that's true for a lot of systems of slavery in the world. But let's say Roman law, until around 200, 300 AD, at least theoretically, a father could kill his children, with no legal consequences. Free children, right? He could kill his let's say, niece. It's called patria potestas, the power of the head of the family. So if you're going to say, well, slavery is kind of defined by in a situation where someone can just kill you with no consequences, that's not going to help you in the case of Roman law, because in Roman law, you could not do that to a slave a lot of the time, but you could do it to a free person, to your child.
Yeah. So clearly, there is an issue here, or there's a problem here of defining slavery. So it depends on which lens or which geographical location where you're defining it from. So that's obviously a problem. That would also
let's be specific, right? It's not necessarily a problem. I mean, for example, you know, religious studies as a field, there's no agreed upon definition of religion. But that's not a problem because, you know, here's the problem. I think in a lot of ways, slavery and terrorism are kind of concepts that are useful to compare because there's no agreed upon definition of terrorism.
Yeah.
But like the reason that's a problem is that if you're in religious studies and you say that, you know, Jedi, if you want to write an article about Jedi religion, like no one's going to say you're a bad person for doing that.
Right.
Whereas if you're kind of stamped with the label of does slavery or is terrorist, that's it. You're morally obliterated. Right? Mm. That's a moral condemnation. So I think there's a problem when there's a concept that you want to use transhistorically throughout space and time to label things that with the effect of labeling things as evil.
Yeah.
But you actually don't have a definition for it, because what you're really doing is things that look like slavery to you or that you want to call slavery, exactly. You end up stamping with that. Whereas things that don't look like slavery to you or that you don't want to call slavery don't get that condemnation. So that's why I think it's a problem.
So especially in these two topics that you mentioned, slavery and terrorism, and there's consequences to that. So one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So, you know, it does, your choice will have consequences in the real world. So that builds me to my next question then. Is it then fair to use the word slavery in the Islamic context? I mean, in Arabic, there's obviously different words for, you know, riq, as you've mentioned in your book. But is it fair to translate that slavery then? Because then the Western audience, the Western definition, and apply that on Islam, and we've just completely started off on a wrong footed.
I mean, I think that's a complicated question because you have to think about to what extent should your answer be really governed by an attempt to control reaction versus an attempt to kind of be accurate. I think, I mean, the irony is that in kind of Islamic civilization and Western European civilization are siblings. I mean, they come from Semitic sources, and they're at least they're highly influenced by Greco-Roman tradition. I mean, a lot of Islamic law on slavery is not from the Quran. It's not from the even Sunnah of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam. It's just existing tradition in the Near East in the 700s, and some of those things are from like Roman and Near Eastern law. And Muslim scholars they didn't acknowledge those origins, but they basically realized that some of these laws were not rooted in their tradition, in Islamic scripture. But the bottom line is that legally speaking, you know, Islamic law on slavery is very similar. It's in the same conversation as European. You know, you're talking about freedom, you're talking about a binary of free and slave. In other parts of the world, like the Southeast Asia, there's not like two categories. There's many, many categories, many, many levels of subservience and subordination, dependence, more like a web One scholar calls it, it's more like a web of dependence, not a not two layers or a hierarchy.
Yeah.
But hang on, let me just finish. So the strictly speaking, from like a Islamic legal and Western legal definitions, they're fairly similar. I would say that the real issue comes in that the way that slavery is practiced in the Americas, after in the European colonization of the Americas, was pretty unprecedented in terms of its scale and severity in world history. And it was also fairly quickly, almost everywhere in the Americas, racialized. So slave status becomes being a certain, certain races are slaves or enslavable and certain are not. And so you get kind of a mixture of real brutality, huge scale, and racialization, a very simplistic, uniform racialization that is pretty freaky. So when we look at, let's say, the people who start objecting to slavery, even beginning with people like Bartolomé de las Casas in the 16th century, and then people, let's say, like Enlightenment figures like Condorcet and Diderot and Montesquieu and Voltaire, they're responding really to the Atlantic slave trade. Like they're not, they're responding to two things. One is the really like the shocking horror of the Middle Passage, and two, what they consider just like a lot of them consider to be really stupid justification, the kind of racial justification they saw as laughable. So that wasn't, those things were not really present in a lot of pre-American, pre-Atlantic slave trade slave systems.
Yeah.
There wasn't this massive scale. There wasn't this kind of grotesque racial justification. And in general, I know this is something that is not true always, but I'd say in general, I don't think other slavery systems were as brutal as they could be and were often they often were in the Americas.
Yeah.
So I think that's why is that when we, it's not just, by the way, that's not to say that slaves in various times and places in world history were not treated absolutely horrifically and as bad, if not worse, than in, some awful plantation in Brazil or South Carolina. Some of the ways that slaves are treated in the Roman Empire is just, it's like mind-numbingly horrible.
Yeah.
But I'd say in general, you didn't have the kind of like shocking scale and kind of just boldness, sort of brazenness of the Atlantic slave trade. And it's the use of slaves in the Americas was really shocking to people.
Mm.
So that's why I think a lot of the kind of abolitionism really picks up steam in the 1700s.
Right.
Is because that what they're looking at is really tough to defend. I mean, it's sort of it's not like, here's this guy who's from another village that we grabbed on a raid and, he's part of the family, he speaks the same language as us, eventually we free him after a couple of years, he becomes our business partner. That would be much more of a maybe representation of slavery in a lot of parts of the world than the Americas. So it's a very different, the problem is that when you start talking about, it's not just, can we say Islamic is, should we really talk about there being slavery in Islam? Is that slavery in the Americas, the Atlantic slave trade is the thing your usul, the kind of the thing from which you're analogizing.
Right.
Most things in world history, most instances of slavery in world history are not going to be accurately, are not going to appear accurately in your mind.
Yeah.
If you start talking about them as slavery.
I wanted to go back to the Quran or to the Sunnah. There are certain concepts, certain principles laid out for us in the Quran with regards to, slavery or riq, to be more accurate, that actually reflect the mindset of or the theology or the philosophy behind slavery in Islam. Things like al-mukataba, you talk about that, the slave getting his own freedom. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran as well, when we commit certain sins as expiations, kafara for our sins, we are told in first place to free a slave. So we can see the mindset, you know, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is telling us and how we should behave towards slavery. So, you know, that is very different to the transatlantic slavery that you were discussing, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have to remember that slavery, like, you know, in North America, British colonies in North America, there's, you know, for a lot of times in a lot of the colonies, you could not manumit your own slave, right? This was actually a big debate in places like Virginia about whether or not people should be allowed to free their own slaves. Whereas in Islamic law and Islamic society, manumission of is encouraged to the point that a lot of legal rules that are otherwise pretty firm, you get exceptions to in terms when you get so manumission. Like the fact that if we have a contract, you know, if I make a mistake and I say something wrong in the contract, or I make a mistake in my writing and it's obviously a mistake, like that's not going to be legally binding, right? Or if I'm drunk, or if I'm angry, or if I don't mean something, that doesn't become legally binding. In freeing slaves, it's generally legally binding. So if you say, you know, if you're my slave and I say, okay, good job today, you know, you've worked really hard, you know, go get some rest, you're free to, you know, go get some rest. If I say you're free, boom, I didn't mean you're free, literally. Mm-hmm. You're free to go do something else right now. Boom, you're free. Oh no, I didn't mean that, doesn't matter. Right, so there, because of this idea that right, the lawgiver God wants freedom, he looks expectantly towards freedom. And this is actually goes back all the way to a very early report of the prophet alayhi salam, that you know, God wants freedom, right? So the Quran and the Sunnah, I mean, I think if you looked at generally, you know, religious scriptures or legal documents in world history, I can't think of anyone that is as obsessed with emancipation as the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. I mean, it's really like the idea of tying freeing slaves to expiating sins. I think this was the Quran is the first time we see this. The idea of, the Quran, you see it numerous times, but where you see it a lot is in the hadiths.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that you free a slave when there's an eclipse, you free a slave. If you hit your slave and you cause them to bleed, you should free them, right? If they want to do a contract where they buy their own freedom on installments, this is in the Quran, you should do that. You know, you're encouraged to marry your slaves, free your slave women, and then marry them. You're encouraged. I mean, over and over and over and over. I mean, what's funny, right, is it's not only in reliable hadiths, but if you look in forged hadiths, probably the longest hadith I've ever seen in my life is this forged hadith, which is allegedly a sermon the prophet gave, which is just pages and pages and pages. And it's forged sometime in the 800s of the common era, but even in the forged hadiths, you're told to free slaves. Like in a weird, like freeing slaves becomes a way of like quantifying rewards. So, you know, if you walk to the mosque, every step you take is like freeing a slave. So freeing a slave becomes the way you kind of, the unit by which you measure reward. And so what the point about this is that even if people would say, well, you know, Muslims, maybe the Quran, the Sunnah are about emancipation, but then Muslims, you know, they betrayed that. What's interesting is somebody was out there making up all these hadiths during the high point of Islamic civilization to free slaves. It's like even more, even more explicit and stronger admonitions to or exhortations to free slaves than you'd find in the Quran and the Sunnah, the actual authentic Sunnah. So this is, and you know, and so it depends. Like, you know, obviously Islamic civilization is a long time over a long period of a long space or a long, wide area. But in general, it seems like if you were to average everything out, probably the average amount of time that somebody was a slave in Islamic civilization is about 7 or 8 years. Mm. And then they'd be manumitted.
Yeah.
And so what the irony is that one of the reasons that Islamic civilization takes in so many slaves from Eastern Europe, from Turkish steppes, from India, from Sub-Saharan Africa, is because they're constantly freeing slaves. So they don't have a reproducing labor pool, right? So they're constantly having to buy more slaves to replace the ones they freed. So that's interesting.
And would it be fair to look at slavery from an Islamic perspective as a solution to the realities of the world? That when we look at Islam, we look at the Quran, it's not a book of philosophy or just set of instructions. It's actually dealing with real life problems. So when we look at the example of alcohol, you know, alcohol was widespread and it was removed over four phases. It took a long time to get out of the system. Interest. It was the last instruction, you know, to be made haram. It took a long time to get that out of the system. Likewise, when it comes to slavery, slavery was such a huge problem that, you know, the Quran and the Sunnah, they gradually, slowly, just kept making it more and more and more dayiq, yani, confining it more and more. But we don't see a final instruction that it's haram. But what we do see is it's narrowing and narrowing and narrowing itself down. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one approach. That's the approach taken by people like Sayyid Amir Ali and Rashid Ridha and others. Here's my problem with that argument is that it would have been really easy. By the way, this is one of the same things that like Christians tried to argue this in the 1800s and people who are like pro-slavery or just not abolitionists, debating abolitionists in the US and Britain would say, like, wait a second. So, okay, why didn't Jesus get rid of slavery? Well, it was too much part of the system. It wasn't possible. It's like, so what you're saying, what about Jesus makes you think that, like, read the New Testament. What about this guy makes you think that he cares about what people think or what's possible or impossible? I mean, the guy was crucified, right? Because he didn't care about challenging the system in the Christian view, right? So these opponents of abolitionists said, like, are you saying, why didn't Jesus just say, look, I know it's not possible right now, but slavery is absolutely wrong. You should get rid of it. He never said that. Mm. Why didn't he say that? Why didn't anybody say this?
Mm.
Why didn't Buddha say this? Why didn't Aristotle say this? Why didn't St. Augustine say this? Why didn't et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody said this. So, Islam got rid of things like idolatry. There was no negotiating. That was a big part of life in Arabia too.
Sure.
I think the main reason is that slavery wasn't thought about as like a moral problem. It was basically a feature of labor, political and in economic life, right? So most slaves were captives. So they're people that are captured in conflicts. And, you know, what do you do with a prisoner? You either let them go or you ransom them and then let them go.
Right.
Or you kill them or you keep them as a slave. Like, those are your options, right? I mean, so you don't have like a government that has these big prisoners of war camps. You know, you don't have that. So it's, you basically, if you have prisoners, you essentially distribute them into the society. And if people want to ransom them, that's fine. Back to their families and make money. Or if they want to free them, that's fine. But the other thing is to keep them as labor.
Mm.
So that's the kind of that's kind of a political element. The second one is economic, which is that how do human beings I mean, Aristotle has this brilliant observation, and I think it's in his Politics, where he says that, you know, there'll be slavery until looms move themselves. You know, looms like a thing for weaving cloth.
Yeah.
Until they move themselves, those are going to be slaves, which is actually exactly what happened, right? Prior to the discovery, well, you know, essentially of hydraulic, maybe a little bit of hydraulic power, but then really steam power in the late 1700s, mid to late 1700s, and then eventually fossil fuels. Humans, you know, if you want something built or made or done, or you have to get another human or an animal to move it. And when you no longer need humans and animals to do that, then you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Mm.
I mean, those things become unnecessary, and they're also not efficient.
Mm.
I mean, it's, what would you rather have, like a car that is run by an internal combustion engine, or like one of those rickshaws, or the guy like, you know, like the Fred Flintstone car, you know, I mean, this is, or a horse cart.
Yeah.
But the whole world full of horse poop or whatever, feeding your horse and having to put your horse somewhere and your horse getting sick and all this stuff. So the point is that it's not, slavery was part of the way people understood basic economic existence of human beings. It would be, that's why you don't, this is a very important point. There's no, until the late 1600s, as far as I know, there's nobody or no society, and I don't even think anybody, who came out and said slavery as an institution should be abolished.
Okay.
Because it wouldn't have been, it would have been sort of nonsensical. It would be like saying, let's abolish walking, or let's abolish, you know, any kind of engine. Like it would be like economically inconceivable.
Mm. I mean, that would pull back on the definition as well, wouldn't it? So like you mentioned in the book, the topic of labor, or, you know, physical slavery, economical slavery, and so on and so forth. I mean, we don't call it slavery, but it's not far off from slavery.
Well, I mean, so if you want to think about slavery as somebody who is essentially working for free, right? I mean, they're working for you for free. So, you know, this is another important thing which you will often get confused about when they think about slavery in America, and they think, you know, people in the fields working and the sort of very raw, like backbreaking labor. But not only is this, that's actually not true for the Americas. There was also lots of different other kinds of labor that slaves did. But in world history, you know, let's say the Mediterranean world of Rome and the Islamic world, you know, most slaves are domestic workers. You know, they're like in the house, they're taking care of kids, they're cooking, they're doing errands. And a lot of times they're skilled workers. They're carpenters, they're rope makers, so someone would buy a slave not to do stuff for them, but to go out and be hired to do something. And then they're essentially like investment. So they're basically making revenue that they then bring back to you. And so that's how, by the way, when slaves are doing this mukataba, when they're buying their own freedom, they're making money. So they're going out and making money, and they're making extra money for themselves that they then put into buying their own freedom from their master,
right,
their owner. So that mukataba only really makes sense when you think about a slave who is actually out there in society earning money. Now the difference is they're not keeping that money for themselves and their own kind of economic agent. They're funneling it mostly to their owner. So I can't remember the original question, but what was the original question?
I've kind of off track.
Yeah, sure. I mean, okay, I think I remember, but it was basically like, yeah. So the idea is that human society, the way that it functions, was that there was this need for labor, need for people to do, for things to get moved, done, et cetera, et cetera. And that the solution to this was, well, put it this way, you could have a society where everybody worked out in the fields and did stuff. But here's the thing, if you get rich enough, why should you do that when you can get someone else to do it? make someone else do it, buy someone else to do it. Okay, and by the way, remember, a lot of slaves in human history are, they're people who are sold by their families. There are people who are sold by their parents, they're abandoned their parents, they're sold by their clan leader, right? They give themselves in slavery because they're so poor and desperate, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So like, there's all sorts of people at the bottom of society who end up in a situation where they are working for somebody else.
Right.
For the only thing they get in return is essentially living, you know, so they're supported to live. They're not paid money for this. They're not paid wages.
And Doctor, do we find in early Islamic history, do we find movements amongst slaves where they, try to fight their owners or run away, or they actually formed unions and, you know, caused some kind of a movement for their freedom?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, yes, I'll answer that question. But I would first let me say that, you know, the civilization, right? The idea that you have a group of people who live together with a surplus of, you know, division of labor, surplus food, so that people can engage in other activities besides subsistence farming and stuff like that. And eventually you get an elite who do things like write music and write books and start universities and do whatever other people do, right? All of elite culture rests on labor done by others, right? At certain times in history, that labor is done, a lot of it, by people who are slaves. And in certain times in history, it's done by people who are not technically slaves. Now, if you want to say that, you know, workers in a capitalist country like the US should be talked about as slaves or not, that's another debate. But the point is that, you know, we're high culture, elite culture, civilization is built on some people doing work so that other people don't have to do that work.
Right, right.
Okay, so then let me say another point, which is very important, which is that one of the things that the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet and just Muslims, by essentially consensus in the very early period of Islam, I mean, essentially the time of the companions, one of the things that they do is that they do not allow selling your children to slavery. They do not allow enslaving someone for debt, which is, by the way, one of the main ways that, again, even more than selling someone as a relative or being captured, the main way in most of world history in most places is debt.
Right.
Become a debt slave because you're indebted to somebody. Debt slavery prohibited in Islamic law. It doesn't mean that it doesn't appear sometimes in Islamic civilization, but it's prohibited in the Sharia.
Right.
You can't give yourself as a slave. Right? You can't give yourself as a slave. The Quran, the Sunnah, and the Sharia very quickly closed every door. All the main doors into slavery were closed except for capture.
Mm.
Well, two things: capture in warfare. So capturing non-Muslims outside the abode of Islam, like you can't go and, you know, there's like a Jewish and a Christian guy living in Cairo. You can't be like, oh, you're my slave now, right? They're dhimmis. They can't be enslaved.
Yeah.
But if you go and you fight a war against, you know, this Christian kingdom or this whatever, then the captives can be enslaved. And then the second thing is people who are born of female slaves, except unless the father is the owner, then that case, the child is free. The mother will be freed upon his death. The child is free. And the mother can't be sold also. And the child, this is not only is free, but also legitimate and has the same social status as the child born of a free wife. This is unprecedented in certainly the Near East. I don't know about world history, but some, for example, it's Thomas Jefferson's kids, Sally Heming, they were slaves. They were black and they were slaves based on American law. So if he were a Muslim, those children would be free and they would be like, potentially the next president. They would be the equivalent of, you know, George W. Bush Jr., right? Full-fledged, carrying the Bush name. The fact that their mother was a slave woman would have been like, only if there was some campaign and somebody was like trying to insult them or something, they'd say this. We would have no impact on their standing in society. So those are big changes that Islamic, they come with the Quran, the Sunnah, the Prophet, and the Sharia. The other question you asked, I can't remember the question you asked, which I said I was going to answer. Now I forgot.
I was just asking if there were any major movements amongst the slaves.
Oh, yeah.
Did they try?
There were some rebellions. There were some slave rebellions, especially the big one in the late 9th century, mid to late 9th century, is the Zand Rebellion in southern Iraq, which was pretty, it was a big rebellion. And it went on for a few decades. But this is important, right? I think this is really important to keep in mind. The Zand were not fighting to end slavery. They just didn't want to be slaves. And they took their own slaves. So the people they captured, they made into slaves.
Okay, the table's turned.
Same thing with Spartacus. Like, you go watch Spartacus, the movie with Kirk Douglas, He's this one scene where he's like, we're going to fight until all the slaves are free. That's not what Spartacus did. They also took their own slaves. Like, there's these pre-modern slave rebellions are not abolitionist rebellions. They're not people who are fighting against the idea of slavery. They just don't want to be slaves.
Right.
So, they're pretty limited in Islamic civilization. The Zanj rebellion being maybe the only really big one. There's a few others. One, I think, in what's now Nigeria in the mid 1800s. The reason why they don't happen is that unlike the Americas, where like you think happening in Haiti, you have things like the Nat Turner Rebellion in the United States, other examples as well, the Bahia Rebellion in Brazil in the 1860s, I think. I can't remember exactly, maybe the 1830s. I don't want to, Bahia Rebellion, B-A-H-I-A, I think. There's a really good article in Yaqeen about that, by the way.
Okay.
Dua of the Enslaved. It's a wonderful article. So the reason that they don't really happen in Islamic civilization is a couple of reasons. One is that you don't have like kind of what's called plantation or gang, sometimes called gang slavery.
Okay.
We're in the US where you have a lot of slaves working on a plantation with a relatively small number of white owners or overseers.
Okay.
And by the way, I don't want to engage in kind of pop psychology or something, but I've seen this discussed elsewhere. I think some of the real reasons for like American psychosis around guns, around fear, around crime, same thing you sort of see in South Africa, especially in the kind of 1990s literature, like books like by Coetzee and other things like that, is there's this pathological fear of the slaves are going to rebel.
Okay.
Because there's so many of them. And if you don't basically destroy their self-esteem, atomize their families, keep them illiterate, destroy their self-esteem, religiously convince them that this is supposed to happen to them, terrify them, kill them if they do anything wrong, right? If you don't have like a total reign of terror over these people, the fear is that they are going to rise up.
Okay.
And there's a lot of them. They're concentrated. They can talk to each other. But in Islamic civilization, that's not really the case, because people are mostly domestic slaves. A lot of them are in urban centers where let's say you're in Baghdad. My Jaria going to go talk to your Jaria. I'm going to go talk to his Jaria. Remember, also, probably it seems like the majority of slaves that are brought into Islamic civilization were females.
Mm.
Right. So they're not being used for domestic work, or sorry, for agricultural labor. Mainly they're being used for domestic work. And they also have such a high rate of integration into society because of the manumission, right? So in America, and one of the reasons why I think you have a real movement towards abolition in the Americas is the same reason you have the rebellions, is that there's no hope for these people, right? If you're black in the Americas. If you're a slave, that's, you don't have any hope of not being a slave.
Right.
And if you somehow are freed, or you're born free or something, you have a target on your back. You're always an enslavable person, even if you're free. Someone's just going to grab you and take you.
Mm.
Right. And the only way to live in any sense of security is to end the whole system. Whereas in Islamic civilization, that's not the case, right? First of all, you're probably going to get freed in a couple of years, at which point you can either stay if you become Muslim or you like it there, or you can go back to your family, wherever go back to wherever you came from, or something else. The second reason is that you're integrated. You're not with a bunch of other people living in a slave compound on a plantation. Whereas if you can get the kind of guns and stuff, you can rebel. Like, you're one or two people in a household that is right next to another household with one, you're totally dispersed in the society.
Sure.
The third reason is that if you're freed, you're like a regular person. I mean, you can't tell the difference between that person and a free person on the streets of Baghdad or the streets of Cairo. So you can walk down the streets of Cairo and you can see a guy who's looks African. Maybe they're a slave. Maybe they're a freed slave. Maybe they're the son of the Sultan with his African slave woman, and he's like the second most powerful man in the city. Mm. You have no idea. So your phenotype, your face, the way you look, isn't going to control what you're going to be seen as in the society.
Yeah.
So that's why I think that there is not really an indigenous move for abolition the way you see in the Americas, because there wasn't really an impetus for it. It wasn't really a drive for it. It wasn't really a need for it.
Okay. Doctor, this brings us to nearly the end of the discussion on this book. But before we do that, do you have any, just general on this topic, any concluding comments? Are you going to do a part two to this book, or are you done with the subject?
Well, I mean, I'd love to do a second edition and just stuff more material in. But that's, the paperback has more material. I stuff more stuff. I ram more material in.
No, I've got the hardback, unfortunately.
I tried to make the book really comprehensive. I tried to make it kind of one-stop shopping, that, you know, you could get this and it would kind of, there's a few things I didn't discuss. I wish I had discussed the aura of Jariya, which is a really interesting topic. One of my students, I hope, is going to do her dissertation on that. The other thing is, I think that's, I'm not going to write another book on that for sure.
Okay.
Maybe an article or something. But I am writing now this essay for Yaqeen on is Islam anti-black. There's a, you know, obviously the issue of blackness and slavery overlap to some extent in Islamic civilization. Not as much as they do, obviously, in the West or in the Americas. Oh. But so it's more about, there's overlap there. I think that, you know, like the previous topic, like it was kind of brought up by questions I was asked. So I mean, people, this obviously has been in the news a lot in the last couple of years. So I wanted to try to answer some of the questions that I'd been asked and that I have myself on this topic. So that's what will be, but it's getting so long that I'm wondering if I should just publish it as a short book. We'll see. Maybe I'll publish it as a short book because it's getting to be quite lengthy.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Doctor, if we put the book to a side just for a second, one of the other aims and objectives of the Islamic Literature Society here, we try to encourage people to, you know, write books as well and to write articles and so on and so forth. So question, why did you decide to take or undergo a PhD, and you completed that, you're a professor now. What was the goal behind that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to say a lot, sometimes people, especially Muslims, because look, Muslims are hard on themselves. Muslims are wonderful people. I have to say, you know, even they get in their debates and their arguments, and, you know, especially in the UK, this it gets so fierce sometimes, you know. Like,
you have to,
like, I don't want to mention the names, but they're just like, it just, you see these videos, you're like, guys, like, you're so intense, you know. But in general, Muslims have really good akhlaq, and they really love knowledge. I mean, the fact that, you know, I'm a nerd. I mean, I'm an egghead. The idea that somebody would want me to talk to me is, you know, normal people, like Americans, don't ever want to talk to me, you know? So, I mean, non-Muslims, right? So my point is that, you know, Muslims are really intellectual. It's an intellectual culture. And that means that a lot of Muslims, they really want to learn. They really want to think. They want to live a life of the mind. And sometimes they think that that means that they should kind of do academic degrees in Western universities, you know, graduate degrees. I think everybody should go to university, but and that's not necessarily true. I mean, you can live a very advanced life of the mind and even become an expert in things without going and getting a master's or a PhD in a subject.
True.
So I think that's, first of all, you know, people shouldn't always just think that they should, you know, oh, I like talking about Islam, I like learning, so I should go get a PhD. First of all, that's not the case, as I said, because you don't have to have a degree to live a very satisfying life of mind. Second, that Western universities are not the place to learn about Islam if you're a Muslim. Without it, you know, just if you want to learn about your religion, then go learn from Muslim scholars. That's it. That's the issue. That's the end of that discussion. If you're interested in things like Islamic history, if you're interested in, you know, specific areas of law as an idea, if you're interested in anthropology, if you're interested in thinking about Islam, Islamic history, Islamic civilization as something that you want to study, not as a part of your religion, but as kind of a subject of history or something, then, you know, Western universities are good places to go. But Muslims in the West should not assume that doesn't seem to be much a case in the UK, but in the US, they somehow think you're supposed to take classes on Islam. And I would tell most Muslim students, don't take classes with me or with any professors in Islamic, sort of Islamic studies, because they're not going to give you what you want.
If somebody wanted to do a PhD, what value does it add? So somebody who's involved in da'wah, somebody who's involved in mainstream, you know, discussing, argumentation, presentation, so on and so forth, what would a PhD add to them?
Not necessarily anything. I mean, look, a PhD is mostly a exercise in discipline and putting up with BS. I mean, it's really about discipline. It doesn't require a lot of intelligence. It doesn't even require necessarily a lot of knowledge. I wonder who this is. Is this my sister-in-law outside? I don't know. I don't think it necessarily adds much. I think if you're really interested in a topic, if you really want to study something in depth, then a PhD is a great thing to do.
Okay.
But academia is its own guild. It's its own universe, and it changes. It will socialize you and influence your mind in ways that you don't expect. And for a lot of Muslims, it's destructive. It's a destructive process. I think that you should think really hard about it. I think most Muslims who go into academia thinking about sort of Islamic stuff, it ends up they get chewed up, chewed into meat, spat out.
That's pretty blunt and brutal, guys.
No, I would say that without hesitation. I mean, I look at the people that I went into, the kind of cohort that I went into, and a lot of them are, I don't know what they're. I mean, they look at me now as an extremist.
Oh, wow.
So they can think about that. I mean, I'm in the academy, I'm an Islamic extremist.
Wow. That's
right? I'm like a lunatic who's borderline not fit for polite company.
So what we're saying is that, you know, university or, you know, higher education in that sense would water you down, melt you away.
Yeah, I mean, it's a society, like people at Insan, you athir bilbi'a, you know, you get, you know, kunu ma salihin, al-mar'u ma ma'anahab. We know, it's very clear in our religion, you're supposed to be around people who are good Muslims.
Mm.
If you want to be a certain way, go around people like that. If you go around a bunch of people who are X, you're going to end up like X. That's it.
Literally X.
Humans are a social animal, right? So, you know, to think that you're going to go into this environment and it's not going to affect you is naive.
Mm.
Now, if you have, I'd say this, if Muslims, if you have a good training in Islamic sciences, if you have really strong personality, then I think it's something you can do. But otherwise, a lot of people, they can't deal with it. And I think I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. But I would say also that, I don't think, and I think a lot of ways PhD is a professional degree, if you want to be a professor.
Mm.
Now, obviously, you know, in economics or finance or computer, you know, there's all these other fields where this doesn't,
right?
In the humanities, right? Mm. In the humanities, you know, PhD is, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. And if you're rich and you don't have to work, then you can do that. If you have a wife and kids or you have a husband and kids who don't mind you doing this, okay, go for it. But otherwise, it's a professional degree.
Mm.
And academia is not exactly teeming with jobs. So, you know, someone who says, like, I want to become a professor and work in a university, you have to know that is, you're going to have to excel. You're going to have to be the best if you want a shot at getting a job.
Right.
The brutal job market. I never planned on being a professor. I always, two of my grandparents were professors. My mom was a professor for a long time.
Okay.
But I never intended to. I always thought it was sort of a pathetic job. I don't know, I could attempt for it. I don't know why. You know, but I always thought I was going to be like a lawyer or something. And then I just kept following this track. And eventually I realized that
you've become a professor.
Yeah, but I never consciously made that decision.
Okay.
It's funny because I don't, there's nothing else I could do. Like, I mean, I have no other, I mean, I, God forbid that we have some kind of social meltdown, because I would be completely helpless in any other,
I think
anything but it.
You'd make a great lawyer.
Hopefully, I don't know. So anyway, that's my advice. I don't know if that's the advice you were looking for, but
no.
But learning is wonderful. Reading is wonderful. Discussing is wonderful. But there's all sorts of ways to do this that don't involve don't involve getting a degree.
Okay, Doctor, we're going to have to come to an end here. I want you to stay with us. Don't go away. We'll just conclude the interview, inshallah. So, respected listeners, alhamdulillah, we've had a great hour together. We've, myself and Jonathan, we've gone through this book, Slavery and Islam, and we've touched on some really sensitive subjects here. Great benefit. I'd just like to show you the website, right? So if you want to find further information on this interview, here we are, the Islamic Literature Society. That's the homepage. There's lots of books there, and people contribute their reviews to these books. You can find this all here on the homepage. You've got the About Us, book reviews are right here, journal, and you will find this particular video under the section of videos. There's lots of other discussions here. There's a recent upload, lots of different interviews. So please do that. We have a reading club as well. You can join us on a variety of different books, reading clubs. There's lots of benefit to be taken. There's a special section for membership, so you'll get some exclusive rights. You can join us on that as well. There we go. You can see the actual Slavery in Islam there on your screens. It's mashallah, 5-star, I must say. Okay, so alhamdulillah. So, respected viewers, I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us on this program. Do join us for another upcoming interview on an amazing book with another author, inshallah ta'ala. So don't go too far away. Leave us your comments under the videos. Don't forget to like the video as well. and hopefully we'll see you all very, very soon. Thank you very much. Barakallahu feekum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
تمسك بحبل الله واتبع الهدى ولا تك بدعيا لعلك تفلح ودن بكتاب الله والسنن التي أتت عن رسول الله تنجو وتربح وقل غير مخلوق كلام مليكنا بذلك دان الأتقياء وأفصح ولا تك